Most of my analysis is focused on what happened September 11th and the aftermath of what happened September 11th. But of course, for me, that isn't totally separate from the broader global or historical context of events. I was saying outside, I do believe we're now at a crossroads in human history. I think we've, to some extent, been there for some time as we're moving out of the industrial age into the information age. And one thing that I think that's significant that marks that crossroads is that we are now technologically and otherwise in a position of objective surplus. There are not too many people on the earth to feed, to house, to clothe, to provide transportation for, to make life livable for, to give communications or certain levels of technology if the resources and the technology were being used for that purpose. And it's also the case that the amount of labor involved in making that happen is significantly less than the amount of labor that's currently being involved in making a few people a profit. But when you have a situation where technology leaps forward like that, where wealth concentrates more and more in the hands of a few instead of the many, where the basis of human relations is commoditization in a market in all of its aspects, and where profit is the bottom line, then in those societies, and this was the case in Nazi Germany at the end of the Weimar Republic as well, where you had a similar situation and a devaluation of currency and recession going on, whole segments of the society then, because they're not needed for labor within that profit model, become expendable. And so the end point of capital accumulation under an industrial model like the one that we're coming out of, or the misuse of the resources even into the current information age in the same way, that concentration, if it's not ended, only has one path, and that path is genocide. And it's a genocide that's aimed at people of color. It's aimed at poor people all over the world. September the 11th, this paradigm shift that they created, in a sense, was also a realignment of a real evil axis that Bush talks about, you know, this new axis that he says is a handful of terrorist organizations. But the creation and the signal of September the 11th, in my view, is that all of the neoliberal countries, all of the global corporations, all of the countries within the concentrated wealth of the world market, all the ones that operate under that model are countries that they have put into debt structures that put them under their control instead of direct colonialism, along with some wannabe countries like China and the Soviet Union, which are emerging markets under those models. China jumped into the World Trade Organization September the 12th. Those are now aligned on one side of the world, and what's left on the other side of the world are the underdeveloped countries and the pockets of resistance within those neoliberal countries. So as Bush likes to say, you're either with us or against us. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. I don't know how many of you saw the Seattle Times today. There's a little photograph of a demonstration. They're carrying this flag that has a skull and crossbones on it. And the text says, as protesters, some claiming to back the Earth Liberation Front, march in Portland yesterday, ELF spokesman Craig Rosenbaum refused to answer questions before a House subcommittee on forests. The FBI's top terror expert, James Jarboe, testified that the ELF is the nation's largest and most active terrorist group. So an environmentalist group is now the nation's largest and most active terrorist group. And they're framing that debate in a way that any group that stands up to them can be so classified. And since we're in a war on terrorism, they are the new enemy. Of course, realistically and objectively, the American population are the long-standing enemy of most of this system anyway. Outside of a small group at the top of that structure, we are the enemy and have been the enemy for some time. We're the last enemy, and we're the enemy that they fear the most. Because for the most of the other countries in the world, those countries are not in a position to do anything about the agenda of these global corporations or to stand in the way of the tremendous military might that the United States has built up here for whatever purpose it wants to use it in, however many countries it wants to use it. telling you is going into a 10-year war, a war that won't end in your lifetime, a war with 60 different countries, a war with whatever countries they decide to put on the list, and obviously with whatever organization internally they want to put on the list. Just before September the 11th, I had been working with Cynthia McKinney's office, and we had arranged at the Congressional Black Caucus National Legislative Meeting, an annual meeting that they have, to have a brain trust panel, as they call them. Each Congress member as part of the caucus gets to arrange the topic. And I had helped her get a panel of experts on the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I had been working for some time to get the files loose concerning the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. I had been part of a group that got the law passed in 1992 to release the John F. Kennedy files. And that Records Act set up an independent review board, and we have gotten to date 6 million pages loose on the John F. Kennedy assassination. It's the largest release of classified documents in history because it did not follow the pattern of the Freedom of Information Act, which was not releasing documents to us. From 1964 to 1994, we got about 2,000 pages out on JFK under the FOIA. From 94 to 98, 6 million. So we know that there's at least 600,000 to 700,000 pages on the King assassination that were locked up by the Congressional Investigative Committee in the 70s, the House Select Committee on Assassination. Carl Stokes, the chairman, and the counsel, Mr. Blakey, agreed to adopt a House rule that for 50 years locks up those documents, in other words, till 2026. We didn't want to wait that long, and we also felt that there were documents in there that related to the program that we think was primarily responsible for the murder of Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King, that was the FBI's COINTELPRO program, or counterintelligence program, that targeted civil rights and anti-war activists. Unfortunately, after September the 11th, everybody's agenda changed and the panel was canceled. But we were on the verge of introducing a new piece of legislation that would have tracked the JFK Act to get the King records loose and the COINTELPRO files as part of the record of the King assassination, because it doesn't have to be just what happened the day of the assassination. We did sue in court on the Freedom of Information Act and get a 30-page document loose after 2 years of struggle with the Army intelligence that revealed for the first time that Operation Lantern Spike and the 111th Military Intelligence Group of the U.S. Army were in Memphis on the days prior to and after the King assassination and were spying directly on Dr. Martin Luther King. Lantern Spike was part of Garden Plot. Garden Plot was a counter-descent operation that was run by the military, had martial law plans connected to it, internment plans for black Americans, fell under its rubric. And so we got that piece loose, but we wanted to get the full scope of the COINTELPRO files loose. Now, in the subsequent period, Attorney General Ashcroft has said that he wants to reinstitute COINTELPRO, that he wants to start spying again on groups not involved in criminal activities but who are involved in protest or dissent activities. So that's, you know, one of the results of that is, I'll bet if we did some background on who this James Jarbo character is that says they're the most terrorist group, that he goes back into the history of the FBI COINTELPRO program that came out of two guys named Kartha Deek Deloach and William Sullivan in the FBI that came to the FBI from the Office of Naval Intelligence in the 1940s and worked with Hoover. They also said that after September 11th, they want to unleash the CIA, that the CIA has been operating under these tremendous shackles that were put on it because of the Church Committee in the 1970s. And so they want to let it loose to do whatever it wants and needs to do, including assassination, to restore the ability for them to assassinate people abroad. And the CIA expert that they interviewed on CNN the first week, amusingly to me, said, they're misled. We don't need those authorities. Well, what they're saying is they don't need them because they go ahead and do the stuff anyway, and they're better off doing it with the deniability that it's illegal than to do it, make it legal, and then be blamed for it when they do it. But we're basically, I think, in down to two paths now. I mean, we can go down this nightmare path of this warfare against basically people of color all over the world under the guise that we're somehow going to stop terrorism, when in fact what we're doing is extending terrorism in the wars. Or we can take a path where we decide that we're going to build a new world. Because the way you stop terrorism is not by bombing people. It's not by fighting back against terrorism. That isn't the way it works. I mean, Mr. Batista could tell you that, were he still alive. The way his government fell down was that Castro, with a much smaller force, would goad him. Batista would over-respond. He would lose the popular support. Popular support would go to the enemy that he was attacking, and eventually build up into a force strong enough that it eroded his authority. So, I mean, you want an example of, you know, how well violence works in response to so-called terrorism? Because terrorism just means an asymmetrical force. You know, it means that you've got a smaller force that doesn't have the capability to go against in open warfare. The same as for the British colonial army, the U.S. irregulars that fought in the revolution here would have been terrorists. I mean, it just means that there's an imbalance of force. There may be a difference in tactics as well, but most of that comes out of the imbalance of force. And terrorism only arises, I mean, a small group being violent in order to accomplish that end only arises historically after a long string of abuse, a long string of injustice, where people feel abused. And then, because most of the human community knows that violence, even though it might eventually bring some sort of change, also has a tremendous cost. Not just to the people that are being attacked, but to the people carrying out the violence. And so, generally, people are reluctant to be violent, even in an untenable situation. I mean, there were intermittent revolts against slavery, but slavery lasted for hundreds of years without everyone suddenly rising up and being violent. So people will take a lot of abuse before they'll get to the point where they'll give sanction or sanctuary or support to somebody being violent on their behalf. Well, I think it's just common sense that if you want to stop that violence from happening, you have to get back to the root of the injustice that it grows out of. I mean, an example here would be the militia. The militia have the same agenda as what we call terrorists in some other country, would use the same tactics. Do they have any popular support? Not for the most part, because most people, especially the people that the militia would surround itself with or relate to in this society, don't feel that oppressed. I mean, they may have problems, but they don't feel so oppressed that they want to support somebody doing this in their name. And similarly, the IRA, 50, 100 years ago, under direct British colonial rule, had a lot of popular support. But as that situation has changed, it's not all for the better, but it's changed, it's modified, and so the abuses go down, then the IRA loses support and is forced to a negotiating table. So if you really, your point is to end terrorism, the way to end terrorism is to restore justice, to restore hope, to take people out of the despair from which they become violent. But that despair and that rage rests ultimately in the establishment of oppression or privilege within societies. The basic violence of societies is that there is privilege. That someone or some group asserts that they have the right to a different kind of labor or a different kind of human right, a different kind of existence, a different kind of access to resources than some other group. And so the group that's then cut out, the aggrieved group, the group that's oppressed, you know, eventually, that violence done to them, which is a violence to the depth of the human spirit, eventually it's going to come out in rage or in violence in that way. I mean, or it's going to be dealt with, you know, perhaps nonviolently. But that's the root. I mean, all the rest of the violences in the world come out of that root violence and wouldn't be there without it. So it's possible instead, technologically and otherwise, and in terms of human will, to build a world of justice, but that world of justice has to be based on giving up some of those privileges as they're perceived. It has to be based on making a change in the social contract. Systems don't make that change easily, but it's been my point of view that what's necessary to make that change, at least in this society, is to restore to some extent, or build anew some sort of democratic mechanism for decision making in this society. Because many people are dissatisfied in this society, but what mechanism do they have to make any change to those conditions? And I think it's pretty clear, and I think it was smushed in our face in the election, the last presidential election, that we are not in charge here. They don't care what we vote or what we want. They're going to tell us. I mean, and that the system of elected representatives, even if it went smoothly, cannot really represent us. It seems to me that it's more important for us to have the ability to vote on an issue than on a candidate. Because how can one candidate represent 100, 1,000, 100,000, 1,000,000 people? How is it possible for them to represent them? Do they even try? Do they come and ask you, what do you think? And make their decisions based on that? Or is it just a situation where a person says, I'm the representative? In the 1700s, you had to put the person on a wagon or a horse, because that's the only option you had, so that they could go to the distant meeting and represent you and bring back news of what happened at the meeting. But that's gone. I mean, we are in a different technological age. We're in a much more complex society. We're in a much larger society. And yet we're using this obsolete mechanism that's too easy to control. I mean, it's 500, 600 people representing 240 million people in the Congress. How hard is it to bribe them, bully them, blackmail them, or bullet them if they don't go along with the people that pay them into office? I mean, you should have gotten the message, I mean, in the 1960s that I got, which was anybody who was rising up as a real leader in any sense, or an elected official who was really responding to the popular will, they were going to kill you. And then that also killed people's hope for some kind of change. So I don't think it's so much a question of people being uninformed. I don't think it's so much a question of people being apathetic or they don't know what the problems are. I think it's that we can know all those things, but if we're disenfranchised from any way to do anything about it, from any way to make an actual decision, to have a mechanism for that, then it's impossible for us to carry out any kind of change in the society or the world as a whole. But at the same time, for the last 50 years, in countries all over the world, in covert and overt operations, this CIA, this military, this $13 trillion operation paid for with our tax money has been making those decisions for us in our name. And now we're in a world where we're living with the feedback from that, with the consequences from that. And if we let them continue to make the decisions into this next endless war, we'll live with the consequences of that too. And it's all being done in our name, as if it has something to do with the American public, the American people. But it's our country, it's our military, it's our foreign policy, it's our society, it's our economy, it's our situation. And if we leave it up to everybody else, then it'll happen to the benefit of the few instead of what we want. I mean, some of the things I've suggested are that we could have or demand direct allocation of tax. If we're going to pay a tax of any kind, that we allocate the tax on the tax form. And we decide how it should be spent. That's taxation with representation. Or if we're going to decide on a policy, that we take back some of the commonwealth of the media. The media is a commonwealth legally. It doesn't belong to the corporations. The corporations only monopolize the licenses. The licenses are issued on behalf of a commonwealth that belongs to all of us. So why not tax time back? Take back an hour for public use for every 2 hours that's under commercial use in the current situation. But without breaking that monopoly hold on the media, we can't communicate to each other. We can't get out the kind of information we need to have an actual debate that means anything, because information flow is more important to democracy than even the mechanisms that follow from it. But if we could open up electronic and other kinds of media and make them democratic, we could have full debates on issues, then we could decide on issues directly. And I don't say we would never make a wrong decision. We might. But I'd say we'll fix it faster than the wrong decisions that are being made in our name at the current time. So what I saw on September the 11th, the most telling thing to me that I saw on September the 11th, was that there was a stand down. Whether they knew it was coming way in advance or not, they at least knew it was coming to D.C. for 40 minutes. They announced it on the D.C. news that it was coming to D.C. at least 25 to 30 minutes before the plane hit. And the plane hit close enough to my house It shook the windows. I know when it hit, and I knew it was coming. It was announced. They said they were evacuating the buildings, the Pentagon, the White House, the Capitol, and that plane flew into the most restricted airspace in the country, unchallenged. They had an official shoot-down order from the White House on that plane. They could see it on the radar coming. They knew it was going to be used as a weapon, and it was a threat to D.C. Growing up in D.C., I've seen commercial aircraft accidentally stray into that area, and things have gone up from Andrews Air Force Base right across the river from the Pentagon, from the Anacostia Naval Air Station that does this air defense in that area, and pushed those commercial planes back out. They have surface-to-air missiles at the Pentagon. They have surface-to-air missiles now at the White House since the plane went in there. None of those were used. No fighters were scrambled from anywhere nearer than 130 miles away at Langley Air Force Base, too late to even get there before the incident happened. But they had 40 minutes, and they knew it was coming, and they stood down, and they didn't get in the way, and it flew over the White House, it flew over the Capitol, it looped around, it went into the far side of the Pentagon, 270-degree loop, and hit the empty side of the Pentagon. So there were more people killed in the plane and outside the Pentagon than inside the offices, because those are mostly empty offices there. So even if you would argue that the first two planes you couldn't have known, that's not the case with the DC plane. They also had warnings about the other planes coming. There were bases put on alert the night before. Willie Brown, for one, and there were others, was warned by his security people not to fly that day. And then DC began to go into a series of changes that I thought were building that day into a martial law situation in DC, because I've studied terrorist scenarios for 20 years. I've studied what the corporations are saying about them, the Defense Department, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and all this planning around terrorism after we lost the Soviet Union as a big enemy became planning for martial law and how they were going to dismantle the Constitution in order to protect the country. And a lot of that is exactly what's happening now, is taking away our rights to somehow protect our rights. But you don't need democracy half as much between wars as you need it during a war. Exercising democracy between wars would be like being a vegetarian between meals. This is when you need a democracy. And this is when the least amount of information is going to come to you. Bush wants to do everything in secret. He wants to have the trials in secret. The evidence will be secret. The war will be secret. The enemy will be secret. At some point they'll reveal the secret that the war is over, I guess, or who it was we were fighting. But that's 10 years from now. You know, we're in the same position as Winston in 1984. Every month they were fighting Eurasia or East Asia, but they couldn't figure out who they were fighting. And if they were fighting Eurasia, the Ministry of Truth said, we've always been at war with Eurasia, and East Asia has always been our ally. Then the next month, we're at war with East Asia, they've always been our enemy, and our ally was always Eurasia. And then they'd have the hate week, and they'd put up a picture of Goldstein, and everybody would boo at Goldstein, the horrible traitor, you know. No one was also allowed to see the war in 1984. They saw films of the war. They never met a veteran from the war. They couldn't find anything about POWs or people captured from the war, even though it was being claimed. So as far as Winston knew, it could have all been a propaganda situation. His job in the Ministry of Truth was to take the news in the past and to adjust it so it met the propaganda of the present. And he'd put things down what he called the memory hole. He had another friend at the Ministry of Truth he used to eat lunch with, and that guy's job was to reduce the number of words in the dictionary. Because they thought if they reduced the words that might lead to dissent, then nobody would even be able to conceptualize dissent, because they wouldn't have a word for it. Okay, I mean, this was the theme in 84, but it really is a very bad situation, and it's not a bad situation in terms of the enemy that we are supposedly facing. Most of that enemy we created ourselves. Even if you could say for sure, and you can't based on the evidence they've given us so far, but even if you could say for sure, okay, this came from bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda, that doesn't tell you who created or planned out September the 11th. Bin Laden was created out of Saudi wealth. He worked for Saudi intelligence. He worked for Pakistani intelligence. He worked for U.S. intelligence. The CIA funded him, and all through the war against the Soviet Union and post that period, been in touch with him and passed funding through Pakistani intelligence to him. So you don't know whose agenda this is just because you know it's bin Laden, or they demonized this guy, you know, for a little bit. Same with Saddam Hussein. He's the big demon, the evil Saddam Hussein. It was the CIA put Saddam Hussein into power. You know, and if they wanted him out of power, he wouldn't be in power any longer. He had, the Saddam Hussein had financial ties with George Bush Sr., with Poppy Bush. There's a multinational corporation called the Carlyle Corporation, where Poppy Bush works now, and W has investments in. And that corporation also is a big investment firm for the bin Laden family. Except they just bought out the bin Ladens for image purposes in the last month. And Colin Powell was running around in July of last year telling the surrounding countries that the U.S. was going to militarily intervene in Afghanistan in mid-October, in July. Not in response to September the 11th. September 11th is nothing but pretext. It has more to do with the war at home than it has to do with the war abroad, but being used as an excuse for both. But wherever the war abroad is, this 10-year war, that's already on the books. My mother worked five levels above top security in the Pentagon. She's the highest paid woman employee of the Pentagon for many years. She projected the draft call for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. She had to get it right within 100 people either way on the annual call 5 years ahead. And I asked her after she retired, when did they tell you they would escalate the war in Vietnam? And she told me that in spring of 1963, for the first time in her career at the Pentagon, they had told her to change her projections. They said on orders of the White House in the spring of 1963, in April, that all American troops would be withdrawn from Vietnam by the end of 1964, on orders of John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was pulling out of Vietnam, and they told her to change the figures. And I asked her, when did they tell you they would escalate the war? When did they reverse that? She said, late November 63. I said, the last week, because November 22nd, Friday, Kennedy is killed in Dallas. She said, the Monday following the assassination. November 25th, Kennedy's barely in the grave. I said, was this a few more advisors? She said, I couldn't believe the figures. I took them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I said, these can't be right. I used to tease my mother that was the first civilian protest of the war in Vietnam. These can't be right. November 25, 63, they told my mother they were going into a 10-year war with 57,000 American dead. That's what they did. 1973, war ends, 57,500 names on the wall there. And we tried to stop that war, but believe me, they know where they're going. And where they're going has little to do with what they tell you about where they're going or why they're going there. Where they're going to in Afghanistan has not so much to do with any distaste for the Taliban, who they put in power anyway, and armed so that they could take out the Soviet Union. It certainly has nothing to do with liberating women. They paid for the end of the liberation of women back in the 90s. When they put these reactionary mullahs in and the Soviet Union fell, the women were being educated back then. So they certainly didn't go over there to free women any more than the Civil War was a bunch of white people fighting each other to free slaves. And these are economic realities. There was something going on there that had to do with taking oil in the Caspian Sea area and getting it down to the Persian Sea through Afghanistan. And deals were cut by a company called Unocal with the Northern Alliance and with the Taliban to do that at the end of the 90s. Then the Taliban backed out. The Taliban balked, and they wouldn't go along with the deal anymore. So that's really a large part of why they had to be taken out. The guy that's now in charge, Karzai, was an employee of the Unocal company that had the pipeline. When they decided not to go ahead with the pipeline, then they started planning to build a pipeline to the west that would only go through the Northern Alliance section at the tip, northern tip of Afghanistan, and the company that was developing that pipeline has been in the news recently. It's called Enron. Okay, but they're doing that because by 2050, 80% of the remaining oil in the world will be in the Caspian Sea region by their projections. What we need oil for? We need oil because we have an oil-dependent economy, an oil-monopolized economy. It doesn't have to be that way. We have many other energy paths and capabilities, but as long as you monopolize the oil, and also we need the oil for a reason that most people don't understand. We're 4% of the world. We consume 65% of its oil. There's already that imbalance. But within that 65%, by 1985, 65% of that amount of oil, and projected for now at 85%, is military use. So that means we're going abroad to fight wars to protect oil in order to have enough oil to fight the war. And it's not as, I mean, even that our use of the oil, it's to make sure that Japan and Germany, our competitors, don't get cheap access to the oil. The other people that are coming in have to do with another valuable resource there called opium. 80% of the world opium is coming out of Afghanistan. And the Taliban were paid $43 million to stop growing it there, and the Northern Alliance took it up. And the main moderates coming into the new government from the Northern Alliance, moderates as they're called, were named 6 years ago in the London Sunday Times as the main opium dealers in that sector of the world. So wars make a profit for arms dealers. They establish new markets or access to resources. They get control over a significant amount of labor. And most of all, they increase the amount of deaths and genocide and reduce the population of the world. They get to test weapons. They get to test people. They get to make money. And then they give us some excuse as to why we have to be part of that war. But a war against terrorism, a war of Manichaean proportions, the evil against the good, we're going to wipe out all the evil people and then only good people will be left. I mean, when Bush talks, it's like I'm hearing a 12-year-old kid describing a video game that he's playing. I don't know what he's talking about. There certainly isn't any kind of rational, intellectual discussion here. I mean, this is Emperor Has No Brain, you know, but nobody's got the guts to say so. But we have another path that we can take. We can make a decision, and we can make it as the people here in the United States and for and on behalf of the people in the rest of the world to take a different direction and make a different kind of world. And that's most of what I had to say about it. I mean, I'm open for questions about it, but that's the context that I see for September the 11th. I would say that the Al-Qaeda and the fundamentalists in those countries don't represent Muslim or Islamic religion as a whole any more than Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson represent what there is of Christianity. I mean, I would say on a broader scale, though, that religion, for the most part, you know, has stood in the way of the development of rational human history, you know, for a long time. But these elements certainly don't represent mainstream Islamic thought, and the terrorism in the world, I mean, what they're calling terrorism, really doesn't represent, for the most part, much more than certain factions that, for political purposes, were funded by somebody from outside in order to go forward with an agenda. You have pockets of, you know, like take a look at in Mexico at like the Zapatistas that are actual indigenous local people that are, you know, trying to restore democratic control. They're going to be pegged as terrorists if they stand up to the death squads that are sent against them. But, you know, what we get in the news, these groups that claim, you know, we bombed the embassy, you've never heard of the group before, I can guarantee you'll never hear of them again. Then 2 months later, the CIA says, oh yeah, we trained them, but we never thought they'd do anything like this. You know, I was tracking these groups for 20 years, and it's like phony terrorism. I did a talk in Los Angeles in 95. It was called, Are You Scared Yet? And my point was, they're doing these things here in the United States and abroad in order to increase the level of social fear to the point that you'll give up rational thought, you'll give up, you know, your liberties, and you'll go along with them telling you who your enemy is and go along with them establishing a martial law. You know, and my main message then and still now is calm down. Step back a little bit. I mean, okay, it was a black eye. It was a couple of thousand people. You know, I mean, we're not on our knees. You know, if you're looking at it that way, defend the country. You can't live in a society where you're going to figure out the worst possible thing that could happen and build a fortress state of security around every single thing to keep it from happening. I mean, you're going to exhaust your resources and go nuts living that way. You know, you're going to be the same as the guy they say that has my personality, it said on the national news, is the same as Mel Gibson in this movie Conspiracy Theories. He lives in this little room, he puts a bottle upside down on the doorknob in case somebody turns the doorknob, he locks his milk carton so nobody will, he climbs in the window from the fire escape from the next building so he can't see him go in and out the front door. You know, you can't live that way as an individual or as a society. And we can't. And we can't. I mean, Benjamin Franklin said, those who would surrender their liberties for security deserve neither. You know, we're more secure in a democratic, free, and open society, in a society that deals that way honestly with the rest of the world and stops messing with people That's the way you get security. You know, I mean, the old adage is, if you treat people right, you can leave your door open. We can't go the other way. And also, even without any of this 9/11 stuff, that this choice about which direction in human history we have to go now, I mean, that to me was just the flag. It was like a little wake-up call if you still needed one. But we have to make this choice now. I mean, the planet is not going to survive, much less the people on it. The planet itself is constantly endangered by going this other direction. You know, so of course, the people who would raise that as an issue, you know, the Earth Liberation Front or whatever they call themselves, that the environment matters, well, you know, that's a terrorist idea for sure. You know, as long as the environment and the Earth is a commodity to be grabbed and used up as quickly as possible. One of the early debates I had about this whole thing was with a guy at American University, and the name of the group that he was in was the Center for the Moral Defense of Capitalism. I said I was glad to see that it needed a moral defense. You know, and this guy's, his attitude was that our real mistake in the Middle East was that we didn't go in militarily in the 50s and get our oil. You know, that we waited too long. You know, we should have just gone in and grabbed it then and taken charge, you know, as if we didn't. I mean, of course, you know, we did what we had to do, you know, for those interests. I mean, they discovered the Dolmen Dome, the largest oil deposit by that time in Saudi Arabia in 1943 in the middle of World War II. When they discovered the oil, the British, who had been in charge of that area, couldn't protect it because they were home defending the homeland against the German attack. Averell Harriman wrote a letter to President Roosevelt and said, we got to protect this oil or the Nazis are going to get it. So they sent 30,000 American troops to surround the Dolmen Dome in 1943. The commander of those troops, who was trained at West Point for World War I and brought back in World War II for this job, was Norman Schwarzkopf Sr. He took his son over there, the son met the sheikhs, and so then when we go in the Gulf War, we get the son to go over and do the dirty work. The Dolmen Dome, yeah. They just discovered another deposit further south in Saudi Arabia, a big one. It's not as big as the Caspian Sea, but it's almost as large as the earlier one. And that was across the water from Somalia when they were going there in Somalia, Ethiopia, and all those interventions that had to do with establishing bases to protect that oil. Zbigniew Brzezinski said in the 1990s that when the Soviet Union collapses, the way that we have to get in and control the resources in that area, we're going to need a military presence in Uzbekistan. Well, where do we just set up a military base? Okay, that's for what they used to call the soft underbelly of the Soviet Union. All of that is up for grabs. I mean, that's tremendously cheap labor. It's all educated, and there's resources all over there. There's resources in Africa from the tip of what used to be called Rhodesia or Zimbabwe down to the southern tip of Africa. There's enough resources there to run this society for 500 years at its current consumption levels. So they have a global view. It's not a global view that has to do with people. It's a global view that has to do with resources, that has to do with profit, that has to do with wealth and the technology to develop it. But the horror is that there's just absolutely no reason and no sense in going the direction that we're going. It's not protecting us, it's not protecting anybody else. It's just a nightmare path. And we have the capability to go the other direction. There's no limitation on that except our own intelligence, the level of brain power, what we can imagine, and to some extent the clock. I mean, how much time there is left to stop certain irreversible processes, but the other limits are political limits. They're limits that, you know, that have to do with the politics of the situation. And they wouldn't have gone to all these links of COINTELPRO and assassinating Dr. King or spying on us or setting up martial law under a terrorist scenario or strategies of tension. They wouldn't have done all of this if they weren't afraid of us. And the reason they're afraid of us is that they know there's more of us, we can think, and we can stop. We can say, I'm not going to go along with this game. I don't believe that we can beat them at the gun game. I think they've won the gun game and the violence game. But I think there's another game that has to do with the head and the heart and making a different decision about the kind of society we live in. And that game, I think, they don't know how to play. They don't understand the rules. And we have the option to go ahead and establish a democracy. And I think most people want a democracy. There's a few that don't, but the vast majority do. And I think that if we make that democracy happen from the local level up, it dismantles their power over us.